Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
And then I realized that people with regular jobs fail. And so what is the harm in trying to do something that seems a little more ridiculous or a little more unapproachable? Because if I fail, I'm no different than a lawyer that changes jobs or a lawyer that fails. Or yeah, I think I saw that like regular jobs had flaws. And so that made me more driven to kind of pursue this thing that I actually wanted to do rather than like diverting into a career that I had no interest in.
I'm so pleased to share information about our sponsor for this episode, Globe In. Globe In is a monthly subscription of fair trade goods from all around the world. They provide beautiful, inspiring artisan boxes that are shipped right to your door. And these actually contain a curated collection of handmade items for your home. These items can include everything from Moroccan ceramics to hand-woven Mexican baskets, tea, coffee, or other little food items and goodies. I loved the cozy box that I got. It had a gorgeous hand-painted mug, and my kids and I shared some hot chocolate. It was just such a great treat. So you can actually take $20 off your first box for any 3-month subscription, which is 50% off your first box, using promo code ARTISTMOTHER, all caps, ARTISTMOTHER. So the special thing about this company, Globe In, is that every purchase supports artisans in remote communities. Globe In is a verified member of the Fair Trade Federation, which means they pay artisans a reliable wage which covers all their basic needs. Every product is connected to powerful stories of the artisans who created them, and you can read all about these stories in a little booklet that comes with your box every month. It was a lot of fun to read through that with my kids. Every month, Globe In has 4 to 5 brand new box themes that you choose as your monthly selection. They also make available any of their previous bestsellers, or you can actually be surprised. You can select that option where they send whatever they choose for you, and it's kind of fun to see what you get. Everything is good, so it doesn't really matter. You also have the option of customizing your subscription box. You can select redeem and put your box credit towards individual fair trade goods that are on sale in the monthly add-on section. Every month, Globe In also has an artisan fund where they raise money for one of the artisan groups they partner with for programs they request, like education or different building projects. Globe In has a really active community of like-minded women on Facebook. You can go find this group called Mavens Community, which has over 10,000 members. Certainly, you can find someone you can connect with and talk about shopping ethically there. Globe In is a monthly subscription box which costs $40 a month. However, you can pay in advance for the year and it can come down to $33 a month. And don't forget, you can use the coupon ARTISTMOTHER, all caps, for $20 off your first box. You can skip a box or cancel anytime. So check out globein.com, GLOBEIN.com, to see this incredible company who are supporting artisan workers all across the globe. Their products are inspiring, beautiful, and, best part, ethical. Thank you to Globe In for sponsoring this episode of the Artist Mother Podcast. Madeline Donahue, born in Houston, Texas, is based currently in Brooklyn, New York. She has exhibited with Stephen Harvey Fine Arts Project, the Every Woman Biennial, and Field Projects in Manhattan. Her paintings were included in Making It Work, a California College of the Arts exhibition of artworks made by artists during their first years of parenthood. Madeline was an artist in residence at the Wassaic Project and at Birdcliff Artist Colony, both in New York State. She also contributes illustrations for Elephant Magazine's postpartum document. She has a 3.5-year-old daughter, Twyla, and an itty-bitty 3-week-old son as the date of our conversation here, named Clement. And I'm really excited to talk to Madeline and hear more about her work and life as an artist. Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
your son's so tiny. I just, like, diverted from my bio there a little bit. I had to add that. He's so itty bitty. he'll be a little bit older when this episode comes out, but pretty much still newborn, which is exciting. Okay, so let's dive right in. I want to hear about your life. Maybe provide us with a little context. What got you interested in art when you were younger? And, you know, just share some high points along your journey as you've made your way and are now an artist living in New York.
Yeah. Art is definitely something that I feel is a part of every piece of myself. Mm-hmm. As a little kid, I think drawing was one of the first things that I ever did. I don't ever remember life without drawing and making art. So it's definitely something that just is a part of me. And I had a few family members who are artists. So it was a realistic life, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like I saw, my uncle was an exhibiting artist in Houston. And then I just have a really creative family on both sides. So it was encouraged or not discouraged, mm-hmm. Definitely a part of my life from the beginning. And I grew up in Houston, which has a pretty amazing, art and theater and, dance, just like lots of culture in Houston. Mm-hmm. And I went to this amazing arts high school, HSPVA, which was modeled after LaGuardia, New York. Mm-hmm. And I really had like my foundation years there. And then they did a lot to help us figure out how to go to college. So we had, recruiters from different art schools come to our high school every fall. And I was recruited to go to the museum school in Boston for undergrad. So it's just kind of been this pretty fluid, I mean, I was really self-motivated. I did a lot of work when I was little to make sure that, that I could learn more about art, not just kind of do it as a hobby. I asked for art lessons at a certain point. There's a really amazing school called Glassell in Houston, which is for little kids and middle schoolers, and adults. So it's kind of just this natural, just really natural part of my life that I've put a lot of work in to keep alive. And definitely in parenthood, you know, I think because I've worked really hard my whole life to keep it a part of my life, cause it's like it's like a limb mm-hmm. for me, art, that it hasn't been a challenge. I mean, it's been challenging to keep working and doing anything as a mother, but, it's been part of this natural progression in my life. And I kind of think about it like golf, like people talk about how golf is something you can do your entire life and
like riding a bike.
Yeah. I don't think about it as a challenge. I think about it as something that I have to do to be like a sane, happy person or, you know, functioning person in the world. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of always progressed.
Well, it sounds like that's kind of always been what you've been known for and what you want to be known for, and your way of being in the world has always been oriented around your identity as an artist, which, you know, but that's not to say that like you haven't worked for it. You know, I think, I don't know. I just think it's, a little bit refreshing to hear. Cause I feel like so many people's stories is that they didn't have any models and they didn't know anybody who was an artist. And, you know, it's nice to know that hopefully, you know, generations of people coming after lots of those who had no models are now finding ways in the world where they actually are influenced by people they know and they see this as a viable path.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I try to find people who are similar to me or who I feel are similar to me. Like I don't really aspire to be like Jeff Koons. Mm-hmm. I have a list of artists that I really love and who are real people to me and have real lives mm-hmm. that seem like something that I could do or want to do. And I think that keeps it, you know, it's not a fantasy. It's a real life career that anybody can have if they see it in a way that's accessible to them.
Yeah, that's totally why, part of why I was inspired to start this podcast is just that desire to like know artists as real people, because I think it's so intimidating to, you know, just only go by whatever knowledge we have of, you know, their exhibitions that were written up in, you know, Hyperallergic or whatever. Like there's, you know, there's just this like wall that I think is put up, and until you have other outlets of like seeing the artist as a real person, or understanding like that they're working three jobs or staying at home with their kids, or you know, it's like hard to feel like you can make it happen without that extra information, if that makes sense.
Right. And I did spend a lot of time asking adults like how they made things work as I was. Sorry, my dog just walked in the room.
That's okay.
I did spend a lot of time asking adults, like as a little kid, mm-hmm. I would ask people like, how did they become, you know, like my best friend's mom was a lawyer, and I'd ask her like how she became a lawyer. Everybody in Houston is a lawyer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I grew up around. So I spent a lot of time asking adults why they made choices that they did.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of fun to ask adults questions like that when I was a kid, because it was kind of shocking, I think. Mm-hmm. So it got like a little charge out of people, but also it was almost like a little performance. Mm-hmm. But I really felt like I needed to ask questions to learn how to, you know, make my own way.
Mm-hmm.
It's like there's something about just having a job that just seemed so hard.
Yeah.
As a kid. Like how do you go from, you know, being in school or whatever, and how do you make that jump into a career? It just, there's not a lot of discussion about how, like the steps you actually have to take, mm-hmm. other than going to school and getting a job. And that was always kind of scary to me. So I spent a lot of time asking questions. And then I realized that people with regular jobs fail.
Yeah.
And so what is the harm in trying to do something that seems a little more ridiculous or a little more unapproachable? Because if I fail, I'm no different than like a lawyer that changes jobs or a lawyer that fails. Or
right.
Yeah, I think I saw that like regular jobs had flaws. And so that made me more driven to kind of pursue this thing that I actually wanted to do rather than like diverting into a career that I had no interest in.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so true. And I just think we, you know, we know how to tell good stories really well, but we don't know how to share and tell, you know, stories of failure and like missteps. I think that's just like a natural part of our society, as you know, especially like a success-driven society like, you know, you and I are living in the States right now. And it just, I don't know, I think it's like a downfall and, you know, something that like I hope having more conversations with people and sharing stories about artists who are also parents, like just breaking down sort of that barrier. I hope that's like changing how we're talking about our lives a little bit.
Yeah, I think it definitely does. One of the things that my high school was all about, they really believed that you have to have a diverse point of view to learn how to make art. Mm-hmm. So we had, I think, four or five teachers every semester, and it changed every semester. We had a lot of teachers who were in their early 20s and then people in their, you know, 30s and 40s. So we had this, and then, you know, people who were like close to retirement, but we had this range of perspectives to learn from. And you'd take a drawing class from five different people and learn, you know, just millions of different things, mm-hmm. based on the perspective. And I think that that's also really important, just in every, like, that's really something that stuck with me in every part of my life is, mm-hmm. like, yeah, listening to what other people have to say, like channeling different perspectives really opens you up to like being more confident about whatever you're doing. And also failure, like I kind of have like a crush on the concept of failure right now. And it totally comes from being a parent and
yeah.
like, and it's really just kind of allowing myself to, cause I really just, it's like, we're taught to be, I mean, not everybody, but I really feel like I was raised to try to be the most perfect version of myself that I could possibly be. And I, you know, I hear a lot of women who kind of say that it's like we're raised to be perfect and it's just so unrealistic. And embracing failure and just kind of being open to shame and failure and all of the things that motherhood, it's kind of impossible to hide with motherhood. Like, it's really made my work more fun for me to make, but also, I don't know, it's funny. Like, failure is funny and shame is funny and everybody feels it, but we all try to hide it. And I don't know, like some people who are really open are, it's like the people that I want to listen to and be around are the people who are just totally able to just be themselves and let it all out without trying to hide anything. Like, honesty comes from failure and shame, which is a really, really powerful tool in art making too.
Yes. I was totally just going to say that I just conceptually that idea of like parenthood being this thing that like, you know, permeates our facade of perfection, I think is like a really interesting idea just to think about as a parent and maybe as an artist. So it was inspiring to hear you talk through that. Madeline, before we go too much further, I want to have you describe what your work looks like so people can kind of have it in their head as they're hearing you talk. And hopefully they'll go look at the images and stuff that we'll share along with the interview. But can you describe, you know, what your work looks like visually?
Yeah. So I paint, I draw, and I make ceramic sculptures. And I work from like a figurative base. So most of my work is figurative. It has people in it. And I use bright, bold colors. More often than not, I use pinks and blues. Mm-hmm. And specifically, I'm really drawn to cool pinks and blues, which is like Prussian blue and permanent rose, which is like a magenta pink instead of like a red or like an orange pink. And I like that those colors kind of conjure, they're almost like Valentine colors. Mm-hmm. They're like colors that are maybe more associated with femininity, and with like warmth and love, even though they're like cooler on the spectrum, the color wheel. The work is like really intimate. So my paintings are pretty small, like 16 by 20, 11 by 14, because I'm making work that is about intimacy, and about the overwhelming absurdity and joy of the mother and child relationship. And I focus on the physicality of the relationship. So one of the things that's been really absurd and funny and difficult for me is how much my daughter has needed to be physically attached to me. Mm-hmm. And it's something that like makes it difficult to get dressed, makes it difficult to eat, but also is this like incredibly wonderful intimate experience that would be really unhealthy in any other relationship. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really funny. And it's driven me to make work about like the dynamic there.
Yeah. I love that. I love too, that like a lot of your pieces feel very much about sort of this like shifting power dynamic between like, you know, like in some, the mother figure is very looming and the child feels kind of like this like little thing that's attaching itself. And then in the others, it's like the child figure is much more dominant. And I think that's an interesting play too, like thinking about like who's really in control here.
Right. Yeah.
And like, yeah. What do we have control over that we want to regain control over that we've lost? I think is like something that I read from your work, probably based on my own experience as a parent, certainly too.
I think that's pretty right on. I think the idea of like loss of control is totally something I'm thinking about when I work, and the humor in that, like just letting it go, and the humor of that.
Yes, definitely lots of humor in your work. I feel like they read as very funny, but like you said, also, you know, this level is of intimacy. And I didn't realize, I'm glad you mentioned the size, because I didn't realize they were like generally smaller.
Yeah, that's a recent thing. I started making them, I had a standard size stretcher that I make. Like, I make my own stretchers and I just kind of have the standard size that I make that's like 3 by 4 feet. So I started making them large scale. Mm-hmm. And I draw a picture and then we'll use that picture as an inspiration for the painting. Mm-hmm. And I just found that like I had all this energy and all these ideas and that the scale was getting in the way of getting just the art out. Mm-hmm. And so I started making smaller paintings and I can just like, everything is done in a day. So large mm-hmm. or small, like I sit down with the work, and I don't get up until the work is done. Mm-hmm. So, the larger paintings, it just was getting like the size was getting in the way. And I realized that really the work is intimate and having a smaller painting makes more sense. It draws you in, you have mm-hmm. to get closer to it. So for like the past 6 months, I've been making smaller paintings.
Has that like just that process of like drawing first and, you know, kind of sitting down and doing stuff within an allotted frame of time that feels more like you're completing a painting. Is that like sort of how you've always worked, or has that pretty much been put on by, you know, being a mom?
Yeah, it's totally been put on by being a mom.
Yeah. Like how has your process changed, I guess, you know?
Yeah. So for 10 years or longer, I painted from photographs and mm-hmm. I've always painted large scale. And I'd work on a painting for a few months and I just got bored mm-hmm. and I got tired of it. And it takes, I think in studio practice, it takes a while to kind of recognize when something isn't working mm-hmm. because there's a lot of like, it's like you're putting everything you've got into making this work. And so it takes a while to realize like, oh, this isn't working. I need to do something different. Mm-hmm. And so it took me a while and it really was just like this feeling of, oh my God, this is just not fun anymore. And then I had my daughter and I didn't have any time. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't have the luxury of like a couple months to work on a painting. Mm-hmm. I had two nights where I could work from 5 p.m. to midnight or how late I could handle being in the studio. And that was it, like mm-hmm. two nights like that, which for some people is like tons of time. Mm-hmm. But I just had to, like, I just, that time restriction forced me to come up with another way of working. Mm-hmm. And I started drawing at home. Like I'd wake up in the middle of the night and have an idea for a painting. And I'd get up and I have like a drawer full of scrap paper and I'd just sketch out the drawing on the little scrap piece of paper. And then I'd take it to the studio and see what happened mm-hmm. from that drawing. So I totally stopped working from any kind of reference material and just like trusted myself to be able to make an image and make the image that I wanted to see. And it just evolved into this like really fun process. Mm-hmm. So now my priority is having fun and it almost like more, the more restraint I have, the more fun I have with the work and the more the result of the work is what I want to see.
Mm, that's really interesting and hopefully encouraging for people to hear. Cause I think, like it's just so hard to work through it all. And I think without like understanding that, like you do have to make some compromises, but that doesn't necessarily, it's like figuring out how to make that work for you in a way that feels actually more effective, I think is, you know, the tricky part. And like when you, it's not seeing it as like, you know, something that's going to hold you back, but like just reorienting yourself to working in a new way. And seeing the freedom that can actually happen within that is really good. And I think that's, you know, that's when people figure it out. And we all have limited time and resources, you know, and how do you still work within that, I think is the question that most artist mothers are struggling with.
Yeah.
So, and most of your paintings, when you do like bigger paintings or, well, any paintings, are they in oil?
Yes. Everything is oil.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm sure that too, like, you know, shifting from this practice of being a larger scale oil painter and like now, you know, you're in and out of the home more and, you know, maybe you, You can talk about your studio maybe a little bit later if you have one outside the home and how that's changed too. But like, I also wanted to hear you talk a little bit about ceramics, because, you know, to me that's like you're experimenting with like a medium that, well, it sounds like you had a pretty diverse range of the materials you were exposed to in school, but like just making that, you know, crossover between the two mediums, like, is that something that came out of, you know, being that restrictive, being at home more and having less studio time, or is that just like a completely, you just wanted to experiment with ceramics? Like, how did that happen?
In a way, the ceramics are kind of a fluke. My mother-in-law is a ceramic artist, and I always have kind of played around with clay when I'm over at her house, mm-hmm. but, I just am not, like, I've never thought of myself as a sculptor. I've never really loved making sculpture. And especially ceramics, there's something kind of difficult about it as a medium. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just this like panic or something that I got when my daughter was born, where, I just see my ability in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot more confidence in my ability to make something. And I think it has to do with this like intuitive process that I have going on, where I'm not relying on outside references or anybody else. Like, I don't have anything in the way of my hands and my mind, like making the work. I can just sit down with whatever I have and make something. Mm-hmm. And so I was with her one summer after my daughter was born, and we were playing with clay, and it just kind of clicked. Something just happened, and I could build. I do hand built ceramics. Mm-hmm. So, it suddenly it had this like different feel to it. And I just had a lot more confidence about what I was doing. So I just made something quick. And then, I was in grad school at the time. So when I went back to school, I connected with the ceramic department and, ended up just making pieces through my program and using the kiln there. Mm. And the kiln was huge there, so I had freedom to just kind of play around and experiment. And I had a huge studio, so I could paint and make ceramics in the same studio. Ceramics are really dusty, so mm-hmm. it's not something you typically want to do in a painting studio, but I had the space to play around with it. And it's really fun. And it's also, like, everything I do is really flat. Mm. Like it's almost like, you know, just like color and shape is kind of the thing that you see from a distance. And I found a way where I draw into the clay and then cut the pieces out and then kind of slap them together. Mm-hmm. It's very crude. And, it's more connected to my drawing than my painting, because mm-hmm. my paint, like, I've been painting for over 20 years. So I have a lot of control over the medium. And in a way there's a lot lost in that, because, I'm making like really informed decisions that are maybe a little, predictable. Whereas mm-hmm. with clay, I have no idea what I'm doing. Yeah. So I, you know, literally just see if I can put it together and if it stays together before it gets fired. And then, the painting is really fun too. Like painting the ceramics with glazes. So it's like the drawing part of my practice is totally accessible. I can do it anywhere, anytime. Mm-hmm. And then painting, like the ceramics are something I can do at home. I can build them at home. I need like maybe a 2-foot by 2-foot table to work on them. I really don't need a lot. And I have like kind of a kit for that. Mm-hmm. So I can take places, and I'm pretty organized. I think that helps with motherhood. It's like, if you want to have more than one thing going on, if you have like organization and like some kind of list or kit that you can kind of keep your supplies together. So you don't have to think about if I had like a big process of setting up, I wouldn't ever get anything done, because right. I'm thinking like, oh, I don't have the energy to do all this setup just to make some work. So I have everything kind of prepared in a way so I can just get to work without any kind of distraction. And then my painting process is more, you know, oil paints are pretty toxic. So I have them. I do have a studio outside of my apartment in Brooklyn, and I just like my painting studio is just for painting. Mm-hmm. And I have all of my work there. So when I have studio visits, like I have ceramic work, drawing and painting, but I only paint and draw in my studio. I don't do any ceramics there. It's been like the ceramics have been a surprise. And now that I've had my son and I only have, like, I don't have any childcare at this point for him. So, I'm just planning on working on ceramics for the next couple months, and it's really like, it's going to be really fun. So far it's been pretty fun.
Do you have childcare for your daughter?
She's in school. Yeah. Okay. So it's funny because the moment we got her into school, we had another baby. So I had maybe 2 or 3 months of, Monday through Friday mm-hmm. studio time, which is also really funny because I got Monday through Friday for a couple months, you know, from 8 to 3 or something. And it's just like shocking how quickly that time goes by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It seems like it would be a lot of time, but then, you know, I had a schedule like earlier this year where I had one full 8-hour day a week. And it was like, you know, I anticipated getting so much done. And I don't know, there's just like this different rhythm that happens when you know you have a longer stretch of time.
Yeah.
Which is, it's not that it's not great to have more time, but it definitely, I don't know, it's almost like I can get the same amount of work done in a week no matter what. But, you know, like I can either do that in small increments or I can do it in one big chunk of time. I don't know.
Yeah. And I make decisions about, like if I have a big chunk of time to myself mm-hmm. and that might, you know, right now that might be for 2 hours while my husband takes a walk with our son and our dog mm-hmm. Or like an hour and a half or something. If I have a big chunk of time, I try to make sure that I'm doing something I can't do otherwise. Right. So, yeah. So like emails and kind of like administrative stuff, I end up doing like watching TV or yeah,
me too.
It's like, I'm never just watching TV.
No, that's like, who does that?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's totally my admin stuff is like something I try to stagger with something else. So it's like either my kids are awake and I'm only half, you know, paying attention, or like I'm like, you know, anything related to food and like domestic, like all of that stuff's going to happen while I'm also quote unquote watching the kids, because, you know, like I'm not going to waste, you know, my studio time doing the dishes or whatever.
Right. Yeah. And I try to make sure I'm focused on my child while I'm mm-hmm. with her. It's amazing how like iPhones and technology like strip our attention. But I kind of feel like it might not be so bad to not have like super attentive parents for the next generations. I think there's a benefit, like when we don't really let our daughter watch TV, but we do let her watch TV so that we can, you know, get some work done, which is what mm-hmm. everybody does now. I don't think there's anything wrong with like me working while I let her watch TV, because I think it kind of creates this like, it's like I'm teaching her how to work while she, I don't know. I think there's something good about me working while she's watching TV. Like she's seeing that I have something to do mm-hmm. that I need to focus on. And I'm giving her a treat by letting her watch TV so that I can get work done. And I think that in the future, that'll give her kind of a, oh my God, what's the word? Like she'll see that I was working and that I had stuff to do, and that she wasn't the most important, not that she isn't the most important thing, but there are other things that I think it's important for women especially to have stuff going on outside of just focusing on your children, especially for girls. I think it's really good for girls to see that their mothers like have interests and like want to do things and mm-hmm. and you know, need to take a break and get something done because it's important to them. I know both my parents like always had interests and mm-hmm. and I think that's really important to like see that you're parents are interested in something.
I definitely agree. And I too like feel the struggle of like when my husband works, it's like he goes away somewhere and, you know, so then when he's home, it's like he's home and he's more present. And, you know, it like that sort of boundary of like daddy gets to go to work and do his thing. And like, whereas I'm like, I'm always struggling to work while I'm doing all these other things. And, you know, I finally just started to communicate with my kids because my oldest is 7 and I was like, but I'm working right now. You know, and like, I get that, like, you are awake and you have stuff that you want to do and you might have questions, but like, just trying to communicate that, like, I'm also working and it's like a challenge to work and be here, but I'm willing to like try to make that happen. And, you know, it's, I don't know, it's hard. Like, I've also been trying to like not be so hard on myself with like the intentional time thing because we, like, that's just something I can get overly critical. Like, I'm not sitting down and playing with them enough or like, you know, but my kids are with me all the time. And so like, Instead I try to like think, okay, but look at how much time you are spending with them. Even if it's like, you're just setting up an environment for them to do whatever they want to do. And, or like trying to say like, hey guys, we got to do the dishes, like make it more like a family effort. Like, this is what it takes to like run a home and participate in a family. Like, you're part of that too. I don't know. That's like maybe just things I'm trying to justify to myself to make it feel a little better about not having the focused intentional time, but it's hard.
Yeah. I feel like tone is important, and like, you have to do what you have to do mm-hmm. as a parent, and children are going to understand, you know, some and maybe get their feelings hurt about other things. But I also feel like children are capable of playing, and that's something that they can do. And I don't feel guilty about not playing all the time, but I do feel guilty about like technology. Yeah. And I do feel guilty about chores because I'm just kind of a busybody. Like I make my dog nervous. Like I'm always like cleaning something. I do think that tone is really important with kids. And like, what I remember about childhood is if somebody was warm, then they could do whatever they wanted. And it didn't, I wanted to watch if it was, or I wanted to participate if it was warm, but if it was angry and cold, then I was scared. And so I've been really trying to just keep like a calm, that's kind of like my focus is like, if I'm calm and if I can, you know, not be angry and stressed while I'm doing stuff, then, you know, then hopefully that'll have some kind of positive mm-hmm. effect. But, you know, then you're stressed and
right.
people get stressed. So right. I don't know. I try to be like pretty laid back about stuff and like definitely have a ton of guilt in every direction. But I think when it comes to parenthood, I think because I've listened to a lot of other mothers kind of talk about and dads talk about like what, you know, is problematic. It's like listening to other people talk about what works and what doesn't has been really helpful for me to try to figure out what my priorities are. Mm-hmm. And it's also like having a studio practice is really amazing because you have this, or for me, it's like, I have my family and I have my studio practice mm-hmm. and then the rest of like day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. And I understand that that's an incredible gift to have. A studio practice is like such a gift. And I really just try to think like, okay, right now I'm at home, so I'm not going to focus on my studio practice. Mm-hmm. And then like, I find time to do the stuff that I can do at home, but I also try to just focus on being at home when I'm at home. And that's definitely going to change because I'm going to be working more at home for the next few months. Right. But just having that mindset. And really the thing that helps me a lot is physically separating stuff. So mm-hmm. I have, you know, if I have my art supplies at home, I have them in a different place so that when I'm not working on a sculpture, it's not in my mind. Right. Like I have a box that I put everything in. And when everything is in the box, I'm not thinking about whether or not the clay is going to dry properly or how, you know, how I'm going to roll out clay and get to work on the next sculpture. I just let it go. And that really helps me, like, keeping things, like, compartmentalized. Mm-hmm. So that I can focus on whatever it is that's happening at the time.
Yeah, I think that's useful advice too. Just like, A, having it accessible. Like, it's not that like you have to go across town to like access any sort of art supplies, but you also have set it up in a way where it's like you can easily put it away and it can feel like separate too. I think that's like a good balance to strike. Madeline, I want you to talk to me a little bit more about like making art about motherhood. Like, have you felt like there's any sort of stigma, like, you know, taboos that you, like, were you ever anxious about bringing your experience about motherhood into your work? Like, did you feel like that would be, you know, that would just kill your painting career? Or like, because obviously I'm saying that because we know some of those narratives exist or like have existed in the past. And I think it's really refreshing to see somebody, you know, who has this compartmentalized studio practice, but also like you're still wholly you. And so you're like making work from your experiences. And that very much includes, you know, being a parent. And so, I don't know, like, have you had any sort of like pushback with that, or maybe just an internal struggle around that? Or like, how did you process, you know, once you had your daughter and you started making work about motherhood, like, how did you process that?
So I think about it the same way I think about parenthood. I don't want my life to be all about my children, but I want my children to be a part of my life. Mm. And I don't, I've always been obsessed with family. And I've always made work about intimacy, and I've always included my own life in my work. And I'm really connected to memoir. Like, I think a lot about, and I also see, like, I think everybody makes work about their own experiences mm-hmm. in one or another, even if it's an abstracted form. It's like you make what you know, and I know my own experiences more than I know anything else. And I think especially, like, I don't want to tell anybody else's story. Right. So I have my own story to tell. I've always been pretty comfortable working with that, with like personal information. And so it wasn't hard for me to make work about motherhood. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I thought about it as work about motherhood. I think I thought about it as like I just feel like having a child was something that I always wanted to do. I always wanted to be a parent. And I also was looking forward to what would happen in my practice when I had children. Mm-hmm. And I always kind of anticipated like that being a phase in my work. Like mm-hmm. I'd have, and just being open to letting myself express whatever that was. So it's been really amazing that like other people can see what I'm doing and that people are responding to it. And honestly, I haven't had any pushback. And I've actually been more connected to, I don't know. I feel very connected to a lot of people right now it's surprising. Mm-hmm. Like I'm really surprised at how people respond to the work, because I think I'm currently making work that's way more personal than I ever did before. For a long time I did like portraiture and I was painting other people, and it was really intimate and personal, but there's something about painting other people that sometimes is hard for people who aren't in the painting to connect to. Mm-hmm. And there's, for whatever reason, whatever the work I'm making now, other people are connecting to it, even though it seems to be autobiographical. And I like, I've kind of intentionally made a characterization of like myself and like a character that's a baby.
Right.
So that I can kind of tell these stories in a way that is like the repetition of it, I feel like helps to kind of tell the story in a way that doesn't alienate somebody else, because it's like this similar character is having these experiences and you can also relate to them because you recognize that it's a character,
right?
Rather than like, oh, this person is redheaded sometimes and is blonde sometimes or whatever. And like the politics of like race and gender, like are important to me. And I think really in order to tell like a story that like really just to be able to make my own work, I felt like it was important to have it be a representation of myself and not of somebody else.
Right.
And so that's kind of how I got there. And I just really, I felt like I didn't have anything to lose. Mm-hmm. Like I think more about like, I think a lot of what I was thinking of is like, I was raised in this time when all of the art history I had was about male artists. And really like kind of the lessons I got were like, as a woman, I probably wouldn't ever get any recognition. And maybe I'd die before anybody saw any of my work. So really just the idea of people being able to see my work means so much to me. And also, I mean, like that, like having any kind of exhibition is something that I didn't ever expect to happen at all, because just because I'm a woman, and it mm-hmm. just wasn't something that was realistic when I was growing up. So, the content of my work has never really been something I've been afraid of. I've been maybe more concerned that like, I don't know, other things would get in the way and I wouldn't be able to be seen. And so I think, yeah, I just didn't feel like I had anything to lose. And also I was thinking about, like Julian Schnabel, who has always included his children, like proudly included his children and his many wives. And like, he's been a proud painter father. And he was from Texas. So he kind of was in the back of my mind, like as I was growing up. And I was excited to like have that. I think I like almost thought of myself as a man, as an artist, because I had this art history perspective from the male perspective. I think I almost like didn't recognize that like I couldn't do what male artists could do. And there's so many male artists who paint their family. And also like, I mean, Picasso, like so much of his family life is a part of his work. Mm-hmm. And you can definitely tell when he began to make work for his children. Like people might not talk about that, but as a parent, you can see like, oh, these sculptures were made to entertain a child. And mm-hmm. that's the kind of stuff that I was coming from when I started making this work. And I think now that I'm kind of a year into it and or maybe like a year and a half into it, I'm a little more nervous about how my work is going to develop and whether or not, you know, anything will evolve. But mm-hmm. so I think you just can't think that far in advance. Like really, like I have today to consider. I don't really have time to like worry about what people are going to think of my work in the next 3 months. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's kind of where I'm coming from with that as a subject.
Yeah. I think that's like a fear that any artist has though, like, you know, an artist who's exploring, I don't know, whatever, like, you know, bird migrations, like, you know, once, like there's always like a threat of like something changing sort of like this well that you're mining. And I don't know, I think like you said, I just like what you said about like, you know, all work is in a sense autobiographical because it's always made from you. And so like your influences and what you've experienced is going to be what propels you to make new work, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's good.
A few years ago, I kind of realized that work was more effective if it had, like, if it had something strong that you could connect to, and mm-hmm. and either that's a pattern, like a repetition of subject matter or whatever it is. And I didn't realize it until I saw work, like recent work by a painter, Cynthia Dognault. And her work is not at all related to mine, but she's a beautiful painter. And she has like, it's almost like every project she does is almost like, a very concise story. And I realized that I could connect to her work because I easily found something to attach to. And I do think part of what is working with what I'm doing now is that it's something very specific that you can connect to, mm-hmm. or that people can connect to. And I think when you're, like I was more focused before on making like a masterpiece every time I made a painting. And that's not really, I think the place I'm coming from now is that it's not about the individual work, but maybe about the story that it tells collectively, mm-hmm. and like having, you know, maybe 10 paintings that work together as a story, or that work together as, like one, like everybody talks about body of work, and I don't think that really makes sense as like a term, because, I mean, I made a body of work for 15 years without making a body of work.
Right.
I think it's like, it's almost like if you make the same painting over and over again, then you'll learn more than if you make, you know, 10 different paintings that don't have any kind of connection. Right. There's something right. about finding a subject that you love, or that, like, I found something that I really connected to, and I kind of just let myself go with it. That was another decision I made, is like, this isn't just going to be one painting. Like, right. I'm going to make 50 paintings about this and see what happens. And then allowing myself the time to just kind of like sit in these feelings and like be open to it, like made my work evolve into a place that I didn't expect it to go. Mm.
Tell me about your recent solo exhibition that you had at Stephen Harvey Fine Arts. That was like your, you know, the biggest exhibition that you've had to date, correct? Attachments. Like, maybe you could just talk a little bit about, like, I don't know, like, just anything you want to share about like building a relationship with that gallery, and like what, you know, led up to like your solo show. And I think that was pretty, like, you were still pregnant, you know, pretty recent. Like, so just like that aspect of it, like working on this big body of work wherein, you know, you're carrying a child, and, you know, and maybe talk a little bit about like what was in the show and what it was like to have that big experience.
Yeah. So Stephen saw my work and asked to come do a studio visit, and he picked a painting to be in a group show. So I had a work in a group show at the gallery in May. And then after that show closed, maybe a couple months later, he asked if I'd be open to having a solo show at his space in the Lower East Side.
Like, and between May and when was the show?
The show was in September. So
that's a pretty short turnaround.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think he asked, so I mean, the beauty of it is I had a lot of work. Mm-hmm. So I was like ready to show.
Yeah.
And I think it can kind of happen. Like, it's good to have work available because people can ask. It's like, if you have the work, almost like Field of Dreams, if you have the work, then something will happen with it. It's right. kind of like, I don't know if that's true, but that's kind of what I tell myself.
No, I've heard people like, well, like I've mentioned this comment several times, but like Allison Remus, the interview I did with her, she talked about working towards a show, even if she doesn't have a show that she's working towards, like just this idea of, you know, like you should still be treating your studio practice as if you were creating a ton of work for a show. And another comment I heard from a different artist at CCAC, at a conference I was at earlier this year, he talked about like always having two bodies of work, you know, quote unquote bodies of work in your studio that like just, they just live there, you know, and they, you know, because like that, like, I think as artists, we have this like scarcity mindset where we're like, well, I've made the work, it's done, I need to sell it and it needs to get out. And, you know, I need to make money and I need to move on from that so I can make new work. And, you know, some of those things are a money and resources issue, and some are like a time and space thing that comes in. But I just thought it was refreshing to hear him like say, you know, I actually want a lot of work around because you never know what's going to happen and who's going to ask. And I just think it's easier to get caught up in this mindset of like, we got to make it and then we got to push it out, you know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah. And I think I have like three bodies of work in my studio, like three different, like I have this Bathers series that mm-hmm. I was working on before I started the work I'm doing now. And I continue to work on, yeah, it's like I have a body of work that's just like, because the other thing is I like one of my teachers said to like just always be making work. Like he basically was just like make work and make work and make work. Don't think about it. Just make the work, and then eventually you know, like the work doesn't come from sitting and pondering it. You have to do it.
Or so having the perfect show that you're like gonna apply for, and then you make work based around that or whatever.
Like, don't make plans to make work. Right. Just do it. And yeah. So I have this work that's just like fun, kind of just not thinking about anything other than just like having a good time. Mm-hmm. And then I have this Bather series that I also love to work on, which I kind of go in and out of. And then which is also like related to the postpartum body that kind of started after I had Twyla, and it's like related to the work that I'm doing now, but it's also connected to like, modernist depictions of women bathing. Mm-hmm. And then I have this work about, you know, motherhood and intimacy. And I, that advice about like making work to plan for a show, that's exactly the headspace I was in. I was like, I'm just gonna, like, I'd really love a solo show, and I'm just gonna make work as if I was having a solo show. Cause also, like, I think people get frustrated with like an open schedule. Mm-hmm. But if you, like, I think I maybe gave myself a few months where I was like, I wanna make, you know, 10 paintings by the end of the month or something. Mm-hmm. And then, it's like before you know it, you're in it. It's like if you're just making work constantly, you're not thinking about it. You're mm-hmm. just doing it. And then before you know it, it's almost like you have this new person that you've just met that you're like, oh, cool. How do I get to know you better? And then you start making different work. So that's really been the best thing for me to do. It keeps me from like worrying about, you know, writer's block or studio block or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I had a ton of work when I saw him. And honestly, I didn't ask him a lot of questions. He's like a very, kind person. He obviously like was familiar with my work when he came in. Mm-hmm. He wasn't like holding a checklist and asking me all these questions that he pre-planned. He was very like, it was an organic studio visit, and he was interested in my work. So when he asked me to have a solo show, I was prepared. The thing that was a little nerve-wracking is like before the work gets picked for the show, or before the pick got worked for the show. I mean, before the work got picked for the show, mm-hmm. I didn't really know what he wanted. Mm-hmm. And so
like in terms of size and amount and that kind of thing, or more like conceptually
work. Yeah. Like specifically the work, like I didn't know what he wanted. I knew that he liked some of the work that I did, but I didn't know what he liked, and I didn't know what he wanted for the show. So I was a little nervous then, but I just kept making work. And I also resisted the urge to make work that I thought he wanted. Like I just kept making the work that I needed to make. And then, we had another studio visit to select the work, and he actually picked a lot of work that I'd already made. Mm-hmm. And most of the show I'd made before he asked me to do the show. And that was, I mean, that's great because mm-hmm. I was pregnant. I didn't have any pressure to like make 15 paintings before, you know, in 2 months or something.
Right.
And then I made 5 new pieces for the show. And I ended up making 10 paintings, and then I think we selected 5 new ones, 5 mm-hmm. of those 10 paintings. So yeah. So my approach is to kind of just keep making work and then see what happens from there.
And you had some drawings in the show too, right?
Yeah. He really loved the drawing, and it seems like that's like people really connect to the drawings. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so he picked the pieces. I think I was maybe 5 or 6 months pregnant when I was painting the last pieces for the opening. And I was 7 months pregnant when we had the opening. And I don't, it just felt like, I think I also just kind of think of stuff like I'm really happy that I had an opening while I was pregnant.
Yeah.
I don't know. That just seems fun.
Yeah, totally. It seems fun. It's like, damn girl. Like, you know, it feels, I don't know. It feels impressive.
Well, and I think for me, like that's nice to hear, but it also, it's like my ego isn't excited about it. I'm like excited for my son. Like
yeah.
I get to tell him that I had, you know, a solo show while I was pregnant with him. He's not going to care. Yeah. He's going to be like, gross, don't talk about that anymore. You're gross. But yeah, it's like, it's, I don't know. I think about life and my practice and also motherhood is like, what kind of fun stuff can we do? Mm-hmm. But that'll be, you know, something exciting to talk about later, or I don't know. So it was exciting. And yeah. And Stephen is really great. And the woman that works with him, Lauren Fowler, is also just like an incredible person. And they have a network of like, Stephen is also an artist, and he's really connected to a lot of artists in New York. So it's a pretty small gallery, which is also great because I didn't have to fill a warehouse for my first solo show in New York, which was like a huge, it's almost like, it's like that thing that people say, like, you get what you can handle.
Right.
I feel like having a toddler, being pregnant, having my first solo show in New York, I got what I could handle. And it was great. And every time I talked to somebody about the show as it was coming up, everybody, you know, other artists in New York were like, oh, Stephen's great. And that's good to hear. Like, it's definitely people kind of share horror stories in the New York art world. So it was good to not hear any and like just be open to whatever happened.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Okay. I have a couple more questions for you and then we'll wrap up. I was just thinking about, you know, like you, I feel like you've done a good job of sharing like a little bit about your process and like how you kind of have these different modes of like accessing the work. You do some drawing and you do some ceramics and you do some painting. And, like one thing I want people to, or I want to start asking more specifically about is like, what about like just education and like research, like how does that play into your practice? Like, are you like, how do you, what does it look like for you to spend time looking at other work that you might, you know, then bring into the studio or that might relate to your work in some way? Like, you know, how do you think about your lineage and the painters and artists that you're trying to nod to or follow? And like, how does that play into your practice?
Yeah. I mean, that's looking at artwork is so important. I go to as many openings as I can get to in New York. I bring my, you know, kids plural now. I haven't brought Clement to any openings, but I brought my daughter to, like, if I wanted to go to an opening, I brought her with me. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's really important to see work in person. And I try to take advantage of what we have available in New York. I Google stuff online. I have a few books that I love. Like, I'll go to the library and just look at what painting books they have open and available. And then the other thing is like studio visits are really amazing. Most artists in New York, and I'm sure in other cities, if you just ask an artist if you can come for a studio visit, most people say yes. And it's a great way to like, I think the other thing about just like research, like you don't think about your community of artists as research, or I maybe didn't think about it before, but, when you go to studio visits or when you have people come visit you, people like mention artists that they feel connected to your work, that they feel are connected to your work. And a lot of times, like I've discovered artists that are so connected to what I'm doing through a studio visit. It's like sharing brains. So that's really great. And I try to read, like I'll go to Hyperallergic or Art Forum, or I'll Google an artist that I love and then see what I can find about them written online. Sometimes I'll like read my friends. Like if people have written about my friends' work, I'll read about my friends' work, because I think the other thing about imagining your own career is like looking to the people who are right next to you, who are doing what you want to do, and listening to what they have to say. I think there's this like tendency to look to people who are dead, or like look to masters and like, you know, very established artists like David Hockney or whoever it is that you love, and read about their work or look at their work. But I've actually found that it's really great to just listen to what my peers are saying.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, that's just like so motivating, 'cause it's like talking to your neighbor.
Yeah.
But you also like end up learning about like what's actually happening in, you know, your art scene rather than like what happened 50 years before, which can be different in another, which can be important in another way. But I just get a lot of encouragement by like what's happening right now, which I think is also related to parenthood.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a very present mind state all the time, like right. since having my daughter, which I just, I find myself really looking at like what's happening around me right now rather than looking to the past recently. Yeah.
Yeah. That's, I really like that advice just to like think about, you know, not necessarily these like big hitters that you have no connection with, like what they achieved and what they're doing, but just like people, you know, in that are in your life that are inspiring, and even taking it a step further and like reaching out to them and asking questions. And, you know, I think there's this like perception that artists aren't very generous, but I've really found that like artists are extremely generous, you know, and
yeah.
many of them are looking for an outlet to be a little bit more relaxed, you know, and less, less like they have to do this performance game, but more like, I want to just talk about my life and how this works and, you know, what I did to make this happen. I think it's,
yeah.
Yeah.
And a studio practice can be really lonely. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sometimes people are looking for a way to connect. And studio visits, there's like a really incredible boundary with a studio visit. It's like usually an hour long. You know, you don't ask too much of the person you're visiting. Like there are a lot of like rules about it or like unspoken rules that make it an easy, like social adventure.
Yeah.
And they're also like the other thing, that's really great too, is like, I think when you're kind of thinking about the art world, you think that every gallery could be something that you know, maybe potentially would have work with. But if you like, Instagram is actually pretty great because you can look at a gallery and see the kind of work that they show. And then find galleries that are connected to the kind of work that you make and follow them mm-hmm. and see how that's like, find new artists that way, like see artists that are maybe like connected to the work that you're making. And also like Elephant Gallery in Nashville, mm-hmm. most of their shows get written up in like a local online newspaper. And I kind of noticed that they kind of like write about the shows regularly. And if you find stuff like that,
right,
then you can go and see all of the artists who've shown there and kind of see what the perspective is on their work. And then, it's like you can learn about the game of everything
yeah.
that way,
yeah.
which can make everything feel a lot more accessible than this big mysterious adventure.
Yeah, I definitely think it takes some work to do that. Like, I think you do have to put in the time to like read reviews and sort of follow the threads. But I think you're right. Like, it's once you do put in a little effort, it's like pretty easy to see like what might be accessible and what can work for you. And you know, just yeah. like reaching out to people. I mean, there's been, you know, like as long as I've done this podcast, like, well, it's only been a year, but I've done like 45 interviews and nobody said no. You know,
yeah.
like, and they're all people that, at least I don't think anybody said no. They're all people that I was like, you know, years ago, I would have never thought I could ask, you know, to have a conversation with them. And
yeah,
I don't know, it's pretty incredible to think about that.
Yeah. And it's also so different to be like, hey, can we talk?
Mm-hmm.
or yeah. just like, I have an art podcast about mother, like where yeah. It's like that kind of goes back to the idea of like having something specific that you focus on in your practice.
Yeah, definitely.
Because it just makes it easier for people to say yes.
Yep. Yeah. Like having the container already set up has definitely yeah. helped rather than just like randomly messaging somebody and saying, hey, I like your work. Can we?
Yeah. I like your sweater.
Yeah. yeah. okay. Last question. I am curious to know like what the word legacy means to you. And, I just think this is just like an interesting, question to ask like artists, both artists and parents, because I think as an artist, like you're thinking about legacy, you're thinking about like the connections, the network, the people that are have gone before you and that are going to come behind. But like, you're also thinking about that as a parent, right? Like you have, you know, mm-hmm. people in your life who have influenced you to be somebody who wanted to like bring children into the world. And now you have children that are going to be coming after you. And so I'm just interested to hear your thoughts on like what this idea of legacy means to you and maybe like, what are some things you're hoping to pass along to your kids?
Yeah. So my, like, I guess creatively and as a parent, as far as legacy goes, like I have my own ambitions. And I don't want my ambitions to get in the way of my children's ability to like live their own lives. Mm-hmm. So I don't put any pressure, like I'm not putting pressure on them to like be artists or to care about my career or to like, you know, be obsessed with art themselves. I think really like what I hope for them is for like to understand like my tenacity and like my, like to see that I cared about something. Mm-hmm. And I also want them to be self-sufficient, like mm-hmm. to live the lives that they believe in mm-hmm. without somebody else, you know, doing everything for them. Like I want them to be strong, and strong isn't the right word. I want them to have confidence in their own yeah. decisions. And mm-hmm. so I think a lot of that is really just like stepping back and trying to not control what they do and trying not to put a lot of like my ego into what they see and like what they do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I think about it a lot because like my daughter, like I don't force her to make art. Like if she wants to, that's fine. But, I don't need her to be an artist. I don't need her to like validate my existence. Which I think is something that like my generation growing up, like there was a lot of this, like, do whatever you want, right. like live dreams. And I think that's just an unhealthy, it's like too many choices, especially having a toddler. Like toddlers need like fewer choices.
Yeah.
It's been an interesting kind of eye opener to like what probably life is for like most people. It's like the idea of doing whatever you want and living your dream is just kind of too much pressure.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm trying not to put any pressure on them to be anything in particular, but like confident and like have some kind of drive mm-hmm. for life. Yeah.
And like curiosity, I think is word that you're speaking to, just like, finding empathy and just being curious and open, I think is, a really important thing.
Yeah.
This has been great. Okay. Final five questions just for us to get to know you a little better. Would love to hear what you're currently reading.
Yeah. So I just read, two books on siblings, which were not actually that great. I can't really find any good books about like how to raise like healthy siblings, like sibling relationships. But I read Peaceful Parent, Happy Siblings and Siblings Without Rivalry, which sounds so like self-helpy, but, yeah, I don't know. It's important for me to try to figure out how to like nurture, this relationship rather than like just kind of just people's attitude about siblings is like, oh, they fight and whatever. And I'm sure like, I know that that's true, but I also think that there are things that can be done to kind of help, like a family grow together rather than like grow to hate each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't have any good book recommendations, but there is somebody I follow on Instagram that I can't think of her name at the moment. But I'll send it to you on Instagram. She talks a lot about sibling, like she's like a parenting coach kind of. But her theology is not the right word, but like the theories that she talks about is just stuff that like has really resonated with me. And I know she talks about parenting, so I'll send you that so you can check it out. Okay. What about, TV? Are you currently watching any good shows?
Yeah, I think we've watched everything. I really love Sarah Polley. I don't know if that's how you say her last name. Polley.
Okay.
And she has a documentary that I've already seen, but I've been rewatching while I've been home. It's called Stories We Tell.
Oh,
And she is a filmmaker and an actress. And she found out, I think when she was 28, that her dad was not her dad and that her mom had had an affair. And she was actually, she has this like big family. I think she has five siblings. So she found out that she was actually the only one who was not related to her dad. It's just this amazing. She has all of her family members tell the story from their perspective.
Wow.
And it's just, it's like a beautiful story. And it's also just like the way that the documentary is made is really fun to watch. Mm-hmm. So I've been watching that. And she also did this movie called Take This Waltz, which is just like such a good movie.
Hmm.
And then I can't remember the name of it, but that Paul Rudd show that's on Netflix where he like, there's more than one of him. It looks kind of terrible, like the, but it's really good.
Okay. I'm not sure I have heard. I actually haven't heard of any of those shows, so they sound good. I'm always surprised, like, you know, what people say, because there's just like an overwhelming amount of choices right now. So
there are, yeah. And I love, like, I love BBC mysteries. Yeah. So I'm like, if there's a, like, Luther and all of those, like, Top of the Lake is not BBC, but it's pretty similar.
Yeah.
I oh my God, I'll like drop everything and just lose my life to mysteries. I love like mysteries and noir and
cool.
Yes.
What would you do if you had a whole weekend to yourself?
Would I get to keep my dog?
Sure. It's your weekend.
I would just be in the studio all weekend. I would really just take advantage of like having time to work, mm-hmm. which is probably really lame.
No, it's not lame. That's what,
maybe go to a movie. I haven't been to a movie in like 3 years, but
I know. Why is it so hard to go to movies when you have kids? Like
we just like, if we've had a date night, we'll desperately want to go to a movie. And then like, we don't want to sit in the dark.
Right.
We
wanna, like, you want to actually talk. And then you can't do dinner and a movie because it's like, that's like 6 hours of your time.
Too much,
and who can get away from, ugh.
Right.
No, I get it. The last movie, we don't even really go to the movies with our kids either, but we did just go see Frozen 2. And of course, like my husband didn't really see any of it because my 20-month-old like couldn't, like he just couldn't. I mean, we knew that was probably going to happen, but he couldn't do it. So.
Did you have to go? So, and you took him to a theater?
Yeah, like we tried. So we found a theater near us that they do like a before noon showings. They do a $5 ticket. And so we were kind of like, do we leave Zeke at home or like, do we get a babysitter, you know, like so that we can take the two older kids or like, it's this whole like dilemma, right? Like it's like, there's no good solution. So it's like,
we never can justify getting a babysitter for doing anything.
I know. It's like hard. It's really hard. So like, And it's like, we're definitely not going to get a babysitter for one kid. Like if we're going to pay for a sitter, it's going to be for all of them, you know?
So
we ended up like, I guess we'll just try taking him, and who knows, if we feed him a lot of popcorn, he might just sit there and, you know, maybe he'll be fine. But of course, like 20 minutes, he made it about 20 minutes and then, he wouldn't stand still. Like he wouldn't stay in the area where he needed to stay. And so John was like, all right, I'm going to Lowe's. Like, just call me when the movie's done.
That's awesome. Like, there are a couple of theaters in New York that do that it's the first screening of the day for like movies that are PG and G. And you can walk around, like they keep the lights on.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
And they lower, like you can ask them to lower the volume and then they'll like,
that's the worst.
You can walk around. Like, it sounds like a free-for-all.
But at least you can actually have the experience. I mean, it was obviously we went to it more for my older kids, and it's like they don't care about stuff like that. They just want to sit and watch the movie, you know? And it was just like, this needs to be better. You know, like, we need a better way to access this. But anyway, what is your beverage of choice?
I drink decaf coffee.
Yeah,
like a loser. Just kidding. And there's this little market called Union Market in Brooklyn. And they have like the coffees are named by the neighborhood.
Oh, cool.
And the Cobble Hill blend is like my favorite. It's really good, and it tastes like real coffee.
Yeah.
It's not gross. And sparkling water. I love sparkling water, just like everybody else does.
Yep. Okay, Madeline, the last question I like to just like offer an opportunity for you to give a shout out and thank a few or one person that supported you in your work.
Oh man, I've been so lucky. Sophie Larimore is a really amazing painter, and she's also a mother. And Georgia Elrod is painter mother who has put me into a show. My friend Nikki Maloof. We had our first daughters the same time, and it was really fun to like, you know, text back and forth questions. And Jenna Gribben is another painter mm-hmm. who's a mother, and she's amazing. There's so many, it really feels like right now in New York, there are so many artist mothers and artist parents that are just like, available. It just seems like having a kid almost has made it easier to be involved in an art community in New York. So, yeah. And my good friend, Melissa Murray, who's an amazing painter who, we have kids that are similar ages, and it's like you need to have people that you can, like let it all out, go to openings with and have your kids run around together.
Yeah. People who get the duality sort of that you're dealing with for sure. Well, cool. Thank you so much. This has been such a treat to hear about your life and your work. And I know you've got a little itty bitty baby to get back to. So I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah. Thanks for including me.
The Artist Mother Podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.